appreciate the presence of everyone here this morning. We seem to have almost a full house, at least in most of the sections. And we are grateful for the presence of everyone here. Most of you probably recall a couple of movies that came out a number of years ago. I think the first one came out in the mid-70s, 76, 77. It was entitled, Oh God. And in the starring role of that movie, playing the person of God, was the character, or the individual, George Burns. He was described as delightful, as the forthright, wise-cracking God in some of the movie's advertising. That movie is slated to be remade, and Ellen DeGeneres is going to become the starring role. She's going to play person of God in that movie. There was a sequel to that, Oh God 2. And I'll confess to you that I did not see either of those two movies. My assessment of them is based upon my understanding of Hollywood in general and upon what I can read about these movies. I didn't go see either one of these movies because I was pretty certain that both of them were full of irreverence toward the same God who sent His Son to die for me. And I suspect that if Hollywood holds true to form, then the remakes of these movies will be much the same. They will also be full of irreverence for our Creator. Jim Carrey is a comedian who has, in some cases, a rather crude form of humor. He has starred in a movie entitled Bruce Almighty, once again, an irreverent portrayal of the Creator of the universe. God in our secular society is approached with a great deal of flippancy and irreverence. God is sometimes described as the man upstairs, and yet the scriptures very clearly say God is not a man. He's much more than we are. A lot of popular humor focuses on God and His character and pokes fun at both, and of course, God's Word also. And I just asked a simple question this morning, is this the reverence that God deserves, this form of flippancy and profanity? Is this not profanity, irreverence for God's name? I want to talk to you this morning a little bit about taking the Lord's name in vain. And what I would like to do in our study is I'd like to impress us with the holiness of God's character. And I'd like to show that that holiness is to be respected in our speech in a number of ways. We'll talk specifically about taking the Lord's name in vain, whatever that implies. But we need to express reverence toward God, not just in our speech, but certainly in our speech. The third commandment of the Decalogue in Exodus, the 20th chapter, verse 7, told the Israelites that they were to take the Lord's name, not to take the Lord's name in vain, that the Lord would not hold him guiltless who did that. And so let's talk a little bit about name. What's in a name? What difference does it make? What if every time someone wanted to describe some foolish or ignorant behavior, he described it as pulling an Alan Dvorak? Some of you may already do that, and thus will understand very carefully my point. That would be insulting to me. It would be upsetting to me, annoying, if my name was attached to every sort of foolishness and ignorance that people could find. And of course, those letters that you see on the screen, the spelling of my name, those are just a series of sounds, but that name is intimately connected to me. when you use that name, it has a connection, whatever you say about it, has a connection to me, because that name, or those letters I should say, constitutes my name, that by which I am called. It forms a part of my identity as a person. Most of us would not dream of belittling someone that way. Well, so-and-so pulled a such-and-such after somebody else's name. But I wonder if we're as careful about the name of God and about His character. The name of Jehovah God is holy and reverent. Psalm 111 and verse 9, the text in that verse ends, holy and awesome in His name is His name. In Exodus 20 and verse 7, the passage I've already referred to as part of the Decalogue, the Israelites were forbidden to take the Lord of the name in vain. Some people believe that that passage, that commandment, is specifically referencing the taking of oaths and the using of the divine name in connection with those oaths. If a person makes an oath using the name of the Lord, doesn't keep the oath, then he's taken the name of the Lord in vain. I'm not so sure that's the point of that commandment. I tend to believe that's not the point. Leviticus 19 and verse 12 once again uses the name of the Lord, or talks about the name of the Lord in that specific sense, and talks about profaning the name of the Lord in that sense. But in Exodus 20 and verse 7, I'm not so clear that that's the point. I think we need to talk a little more about name, because name is a concept a little broader than simply the letters that make up the sounds by which I'm called, Alan Dvorak, or in the case of your name. In the Old Testament, Wilson, as he comments on the words that are translated name, here's what he says about them as far as possible meanings. He says, sometimes it just means the name or title that's given to a person by which it's marked or distinguished from others. Aren't you glad there's just one Alan Dvorak? That's a uniqueness that I have. That name is applied specifically to me. But he goes on to say, Wilson does, that that word can refer to the character, good or bad, by which persons are marked. And he makes a rather telling comment in his work on Old Testament words. He says the name is supposed to correspond to the nature of a person or thing, to express some qualities or circumstances related to them. Hence, here's what he says, the name of God sometimes signifies the nature and properties and attributes of God, such as His power and wisdom, goodness, majesty, holiness, justice, and truth. When you talk about the name of God, at least in many instances in the Old Testament, it does not seem to be specifically speaking only of that name or word by which God is called, but that it comprehends all that God is. And it's interesting to me that Thayer, in commenting on the word name in the New Testament, in the Greek language, makes much the same point. He gives the same basic two definitions. Sometimes name just means that by which you're called. Sometimes, however, he says, in this second quotation up here, he says, by a usage chiefly Hebraistic, my tongue is not working this morning, the name is used for everything which the name covers, everything that the thought or feeling of which is roused in the mind by mentioning, hearing, remembering the name. That is, and here's his description, his summary of what name comprehends. It comprehends one's rank, authority, interest, pleasure, command, excellency, deeds. And then he goes on to make the application to God. He says, according to a very frequent usage in the Old Testament, the name of God in the New Testament is used for all those qualities which to His worshipers are summed up in that name and by which God makes Himself known to men. It is therefore equivalent to His divinity. So when we talk about taking the name of the Lord in vain, while we may think specifically of that name or that word by which God is called, the word seems to comprehend, name seems to comprehend all that God is. His character, His majesty, His power, His authority, all of that. None of that is to be approached with irreverence or in vanity, in emptiness, treated that way. I think it's important that we understand these particular meanings of the word name. There are a number of indications, clear indications in the Old Testament of God's holiness, likewise in the New. Let me just point out a handful of those. In the New Testament, in Matthew, the 6th chapter, as Jesus instructed the listeners on the Sermon on the Mount about prayer, He begins by saying, "Hallowed be your name." Hallowed is a word that means set apart or sanctified. God's name, all that God is to be set apart. It's to be sanctified. It's to be treated in a fashion befitting that which is or that person who is holy. Not to be taken lightly or irreverently or in a profane manner. In the Old Testament, God's holiness was illustrated very clearly on a number of occasions. I'm just going to cite three, two of them specific and one a specific historical examples and one more just a principle of the law. When God came down on Mount Sinai in Exodus, the 19th chapter, it's interesting that the instructions of God were that the people were to stay clear of the mount. They weren't to approach the mount. God is holy. God is so much above man. He will not condone or put up with contact with sinful man. Man was to stay back. God in this case was unapproachable except by Moses, of course, as the text goes on to point out. On the Day of Atonement, the high priest went into the Holy of Holies, the most holy place, the sanctuary within the tabernacle courtyard, that room where the Ark of the Covenant was, where God's presence came to meet with man. Not everybody could go in there, and even the high priest was not allowed to go in there without blood. He took blood in for expiation, for atonement for his sins first, and then later for the sins of the people, he brought in the blood of a goat. But my point is that there wasn't just free access to this Ark of the Covenant where God's presence was on earth. Once again, indicating the holiness of God. He didn't just march right in there, not even the high priest, not without blood. Atonement for sin. An historical example, when the Ark of the Covenant was moved by David, it was improperly moved. And there was a man, Uzzah by name, who came and in an effort apparently to protect the ark, to keep it from falling or tipping over in the ox cart in which it was being transported, he reached out and he touched that which was untouchable. As it represented this connection with God and the presence of God, no one was to touch that. Not even the people who carried it from place to place in the days of the tabernacle. And so those three things, among many others that we could cite, illustrate the holiness of God and the reverence with which God or man was to approach God. In contrast to holiness, a profane thing is that which is common, that which is suitable for ordinary use. The word that is translated or that is behind the concept of profanity in the Greek language is an interesting word. It literally refers to the threshold, that which is trodden on. You don't pay much attention to your threshold. Feet go over it all the time. In fact, we put a rug there or some sort of a mat or something to take the dirt off of our feet. We care nothing about that mat. It's not the special thing. The carpet or the floor inside is what we're protecting. That's unprotected. It's common. It is, in biblical language, profane. Not meaning anything sinful, but simply that it is not holy. It's not sanctified. It's not special. It's not clean. In fact, it's designed to take away uncleanness. That's profane. Something that is common as opposed to being holy or special. Now, I asked Glenn to read from Genesis 25 because that passage illustrates so very well the concept of profanity. Esau, of course, as the firstborn, would have been the one in line for the promise to inherit the spiritual promises that had been given to Abraham and then repeated for Isaac. But Esau didn't care about those things. And that's illustrated well by the fact that in the case of a little bit of hunger, he comes in from the field and he sells his birthright for a plate of food. That's the estimation that he placed on it. He despised it, the text says. And the Hebrew writer concludes that Esau was a profane person. It's not talking about his language. It's talking about his attitude toward holy things, sacred things, special things. The promise was special. It was sacred. It was an important part of the redemptive plan, and Esau cared nothing about his part in that. Sold it for a plate of food. And so the Hebrew writer in chapter 12 and verse 16 says that he was a profane person who for one morsel of food sold his birthright. Now, my point is, you and I can be profane people. And once again, not talking about our language particularly, but our attitude toward those things that are sacred, that are holy, can reflect our own profanity, our own lack of appreciation for that which is holy and sacred. Or in the case of God, that whom, the person who is holy and sacred. Profanity could involve much more than the uttering of filthy words or words which reflect irreverence for God. But it is that which I want to focus on in the rest of our study, in the few moments that are left to us this morning. The name of God, just the word that designates our Creator, is often used lightly, flippantly, in a profane or an irreverent way. I like what Glenn Seaton, a Christian, one time wrote. He said, and I quote, "One day the name of God means creator or redeemer, and the next day it means roughly, wow." And that is an illustration of how we can take what is holy, sacred, and turn it into nothing more than that which is common and of very little consequence. There are a couple of words that we need to pay attention to. One of them is the word byword. Americans are in love with bywords. In our language, we commonly use interjections. We'll say something just to be saying something. Use a word that expresses surprise or anger or shock. We don't think too much about the meaning of the word. It's just something to say that expresses an emotion. A byword is a word or phrase that's often used for emphasis or affectation. It's a pet expression. Some people fill their language, their conversation with these bywords. Another word of some interest to us is the word euphemism. Garbage collector is not a garbage collector. He's a sanitation engineer. That's a euphemism. It's the substitution of an expression that is somewhat more appealing or less offensive in the place of another. The euphemism is that which makes us feel good. You can see that from the root of the word euphemism. And I'm afraid that sometimes, while we might not openly use the word God or some other representation of divinity, we wouldn't use that in our speech, we might substitute other euphemistic expressions that essentially have the same connotation. Let me say to you at this point that I do not believe that every expression that Webster necessarily would indicate is a euphemistic expression for deity or something associated with deity is necessarily so. I think there are expressions that people use in mention of that. But there are some that I think are clearly euphemistic, and they essentially constitute the use of some altered form of God's name or something associated with God in a flippant way. And you know what I'm talking about. People use the word gosh or golly or gad all the time to talk about, they don't want to say God, but they'll use that word instead. Is that profanity? Is that the use of God's name, at least in an altered form, in an irreverent way? Well, you can be the judge about that. The principle is clear. Other words like geez or gee or lordy. And I suppose we could put others up here, but these, I think, are fairly clear. And what they represent are bywords. Bywords that are employing in a euphemistic sense or in a euphemistic way some sort of altered form of God or Jesus or Lord. For people who don't want to say those words because they understand that would be profane, just to use them in an irreverent, in a flippant way. But we make the substitution. I personally think we shouldn't do that. I think that constitutes taking the Lord's name in vain. The Jews missed the point of the third commandment. It's almost laughable, the state in which they find themselves. They really don't know the proper pronunciation of the name of God or the word that's designating God in the Old Testament because they refuse to pronounce it lest they take it in vain. The very beginning of the sermon on the title slide, there was a fellow there with a zipper on his mouth. I almost didn't use him. Because I'm not suggesting to you that the name of God should never pass our lips. That would be the wrong thing. We ought to sound the name of God everywhere. That's evangelism. Telling people about God and His character and His power and His majesty and His grace. But we need to be careful that in our use of God's name, in our speech about God, in our speech about holy things or things related to God, that we are not irreverent. The Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. The old law said, and I believe that principle is clear in the new law also. And I think we need to be careful about the speech patterns that we unwittingly adopt. You know, young people sometimes have that problem. They're around other people at school and they pick up the pet expressions, the bywords that their friends use. We need to be careful about that. I can remember my parents asking me, "Where did you hear that? Who's been saying that? That you're saying it?" Their point was, you ought not to be saying that. I think we need to be careful. We need to approach God with reverence. Not only in our worship, I believe we do that. I believe you're very serious here. But in our speech as we go about our daily lives, even our speech, what we are willing to say and what we are unwilling to say, ought to reflect our commitment to and our understanding of the holiness of God, majesty of God and His character. In James, the first chapter, James talked about the man who didn't bridle his tongue. In James 1 and verse 26, James said, "If anyone among you thinks he is religious and does not bridle his tongue but deceives his own heart, this one's religion is useless." I would conclude that it does me very little good to come here and offer my worship to God on Sunday and on Wednesday or whatever other occasions that I might worship Him in this place, and then go out on Monday and Tuesday and in my daily life and in a flippant and profane way fail to control my tongue and to show the proper reverence for my Creator. I'd like for you, as we close this morning, to turn to Ephesians, the fifth chapter. Ephesians chapter 5. I like the language of Paul here. Beginning in verse 1. Ephesians 5 and verse 1. He says, "Therefore be imitators of God as dear children, and walk in love as Christ also has loved us and given himself for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet smelling aroma. But fornication and all uncleanness or covetousness, let it not even be named among you as is fitting for saints. Neither filthiness, nor foolish talking, nor coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather giving of thanks. The expression that I wanted to draw your attention to in verse 3, let it not even be named among you as is fitting for saints. There's a certain kind of conduct, there's a certain kind of language that both God expects and really the world expects of those people who are holy ones who belong to God. I had the opportunity to be in Dallas just not too long ago at a lectureship there at the Westside Congregation in Irving. The theme was evangelism, and one of the speakers there, Philip Mullins, as I recall, made the observation that he knew of a young woman who was going to college, and in this class of people who were constantly communicating, it was all kinds of profanity and filthiness and gossip and stuff carrying being said. But there was a woman in that class who observed another woman who never participated, didn't laugh about it, didn't make a big deal out of it, but she never did those things. And the one woman sought the other woman out and said, I've noticed. Made a big impression on her. The opportunity to teach the gospel. Because the second woman saw in that first woman what was fitting for a Christian. It ought never to be named among us as saints that our language is profane, that it is coarse, that it is unclean, or that we take the Lord's name in vain. It's a matter of reverence. The lesson is yours. I've talked to you just about one aspect, primarily, of our holiness, of our sanctity, that is, of our speech. But the fact of the matter is, when an individual obeys the gospel, what happens is, upon their trusting faith in God, their repentance of their sins, and their confession of Jesus Christ, they're buried in baptism for the remission of their sins. And the blood of Jesus Christ, as they're buried into His death, that blood cleanses them. They become pure and holy. Or as the Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians 6, they're washed, they're justified, and they're sanctified. And then the rest of their lives, their entire life, both their thoughts and their speech, in addition to their action, all of their life is to be lived in submission to and in sanctity for God. And I trust the majority of us are already doing that. I encourage you in that. If you find yourself outside of the body of Christ, you've never done those things, will you give to God the respect that He deserves as your Creator? You offer to Him the respect and reverence that He deserves as your Redeemer, one who sent His own Son to die for you. Will you offer your obedience to the gospel this morning? And being baptized into Christ, become one of His children, a Christian, nothing more, nothing less, a Christian, one who belongs to Christ and who strives to be conformed to the image of God's Son in His character. If you need to do that this morning, we stand to invite you, even as we sing. Won't you come to the front?